Hello and welcome back to our digital class on physical chemistry of polymers. You're listening to its 8th lesson unit, entitled Phase Diagrams. In our last, the 7th lesson unit, we have got to know a theoretical framework to appraise the miscibility of polymers with additional components, either low molar mass solvents or other polymers. A key element in that Flory-Huggins theory is the Flory-Huggins interaction parameter, which is a dimensionless measure for the degree of thermodynamic match, or we should actually better say mismatch, between the polymer and the other component, meaning the solvent if we consider a polymer solution, or the other polymer if we consider a polymer blend. Our last lesson unit has brought us a conceptual understanding of what this parameter is, in the sense that we have got to know it as an energy balance of a mixing process on molecular or particulate levels. It balances the energy of the mixed state in comparison to the energies of the demixed states, relative to the elementary step-width unit of the thermal energy ladder KBT, and the lattice geometry, on which our whole modeling relies upon in the Flory-Huggins theoretical framework. Our semi-quantitative understanding so far tells us that the bigger this parameter is, the poorer will be our chance to observe miscibility. Because in this case, the generally disfavorable enthalpic part of the Flory-Huggins equation for Gibbs mixing free energy will outweigh the generally favorable entropic part of the equation. Conceptually, in this case, the energy of the mixed state is less favorable than the sum energy of the demixed states. What we are lacking still is a fully quantitative understanding of this, meaning what exactly is the value of the Flory-Huggins chi parameter, whereupon which miscibility transitions into immiscibility and vice versa. And how does this depend on further parameters such as temperature and composition of the system? This is on the agenda of this present lesson unit, in which we want to derive a quantitative plot of these parameters against each other to delimit regions of miscibility from regions of immiscibility from one another. In short, we want to create a phase diagram. At this point, in a classical lecture hall setting of this course, I usually ask a question to the audience, which is, what do you remember from your elementary physical chemistry education about phase diagrams? And then usually there is a big silence in the audience. In a second step, I then ask a more specific question, which is, what is a phase diagram? And this is a question that, after some thinking, we can easily address. A phase diagram is a plot of two practically relevant variables against each other, such to create a map with regions that show at what combination of these variables the system is in what state. A classical example from Physical Chemistry 1 is a one-component phase diagram. If we consider a system with just one component, the practically relevant variables to describe the state of that system are pressure and temperature. If we plot these against each other, we can delimit regions wherein which our component will be in a solid state, a liquid state, or a gassy state. The solid state is observed at low temperatures and more or less any kind of pressure. The gassy state is observed at high temperatures and low pressures. And the liquid state is observed at intermediate temperatures and not too low pressures. In the very extreme of both high temperatures and high pressures, the gassy and the liquid state are no longer distinguishable, and we speak about a supercritical fluid. The point beyond which that regime is observed is named critical point. We also know it from a different kind of plot, namely a PV plot of gas isotherms that below that point show the hopefully well-known van der Waals loops, denoting the existence of a two-phase region in which condensation sets in upon compression. In the PT representation, which we name phase diagram, lines that delimit one region from the other, which are obtained from the Clapeyron equation, are named coexistence lines. And there is one point, one combination of variables, P and T, where our substance is present in all its three aggregation states. This is named the triple point. In the following, we want to plot something similar for polymer-solvent mixtures, footnote, or polymer-polymer mixtures. With that, we are considering a two-component mixture. And this means one of the two variables that describe the state of the system must certainly be the system's composition, reflected by the volume fraction of one of the two components. In our case, this means of polymer A, that is dissolved in solvent B. Footnote, or mixed with a second polymer B. The other variable should be one that captures the thermal energy in the system, because that is certainly a relevant quantity to appraise to what extent interactions between the components can be overcome or not. So the second variable in our phase diagram will be temperature. That means in the following, we seek for the ability to draw a plot of temperature versus composition of the system, meaning versus volume fraction, delimiting to us regions where the system is in a one-phase state versus where it is in a two-phase state. In other words, where it is mixed or demixed. The goal of this lesson unit is to derive equations that combine these two state variables, temperature and composition, giving us line plots that delimit these different regions in the map. For this purpose, to obtain these equations, we must proceed step by step and appraise a yet even more fundamental quantity, which is the most fundamental and comprehensive state function in chemical thermodynamics, free energy. Footnote, this one component phase diagram, P over T, that shows us regions of solidity, liquidity, and gaseous appearance, is actually nothing else than a two-dimensional projection of a more fundamental three-dimensional plot of energy against these two variables, wherein which we can draw a three-dimensional data set for energy as a function of P and T, for the gaseous, for the liquid, and for the solid state. In all those regions, meaning at all combinations of P and T, where the gassy state has energy values that are deeper than the ones from the liquid and the solid state, the gas will be present. At all those regions in the diagram, meaning at all those combinations of P and T, where the energy values of the liquid state are the deepest, the liquid state will be present. And at those regions of the diagram, at those combinations of P and T, where the energies of the solid state are the deepest, the solid state will be present. And at those combinations of those variables, where two of these states have the same energies, they will be both present, meaning the projection in the PT plane will then denote a coexistence line. And as said, there is one point where all the three-dimensional datasets coincide. That combination of variables denotes the triple point. Something similar has to be appraised now here. We appraise the free energy of the system as a function of its composition and thermodynamic interactions, and then eventually project, so to speak, this into a map of temperature versus composition by appraising what kind of state, mixed or demixed, will be stable or instable at certain combinations of these variables. That means we must start our very discussion by considering equilibrium and stability. We can very generally say that the state of mixing versus demixing of a system with a component of interest A at a certain initial composition phi 0 is determined by the absolute values of the free energy of the mixed phase, F mix, and the sum free energy of two separated phases, alpha and beta, which we name F alpha beta. In the case where F mix is smaller than F alpha beta, the mixture is stable, meaning both components will spontaneously mix and stay mixed. Whereas by contrast, in the case where F mix is larger than F alpha beta, the mixture is unstable, meaning the components won't mix, or if they have been pre-mixed somehow, they will spontaneously demix. As a working tool for the following mathematical treatment, we write in equation 4.20 an expression of how a system's composition phi 0 will spread over two phases in the case of phase separation. If our component of interest A is present at a volume fraction of phi 0, and then phase separation occurs, we will obtain two phases alpha and beta, within which our component of interest A is present to an extent phi alpha in the alpha phase and phi beta in the beta phase. Of those phases, we will have fractions of F alpha and F beta. With these very same measures, we can also write an expression for the energy of the phase separated state, F alpha beta, which we can appraise by a similar sum. F alpha beta is equal to the fraction of the alpha phase times the free energy of the alpha phase, plus the fraction of the beta phase, times the energy of the beta phase. By combining this latter equation with equation 420, we get equation 421, which gives us the energy of the separated alpha-beta state as a function of the variable phi 0, which is an initial system's composition. If we set this as a variable, meaning if we look upon this at different realizations of an initial composition phi 0, equation 4.21 has the form of a linear equation. When plotted, it gives a straight line. We can also estimate the free energy of the mixed state. This is something we have actually done already in our last lesson unit. It's given by the Flory-Huggins formula, equation 4.22. Footnote here, this form of the equation corresponds to the form of our last lesson unit, which was equation 4.13, in the sense that the former volume fraction of component A, phi A, is now just named phi, whereas the former volume fraction of the component B, phi B, is now written as 1 minus phi A, or shortly 1 minus phi, which we can do because just as mole fractions, the volume fractions of the components in the system are additive to 1. This equation has the form of a curve when plotted. We see the two functions, 421 and 422, plotted in figure 52, where we delimit two different possible scenarios. Panel A shows a system where demixing is more favorable. Here, the curve of the mixed state lies on top of the straight line of the demixed state in an interval of interest between the compositions phi alpha and phi beta. So here, the energy of the mixed state is higher than the energy of the phase-separated state. Meaning, if the system is somehow mixed, we have an energy of F mix, and this energy can spontaneously be lowered down to the energy F alpha beta by spontaneous phase separation, which will then actually split into subsystems, namely the two separated phases alpha and beta, wherein which our component of interest has volume fractions phi alpha and phi beta, corresponding to separate free energies of F alpha and F beta, which in that combination of F alpha with phi alpha and F beta with phi beta averages to F alpha beta with phi zero. The fractions of these two phases, small f alpha and small f beta, are given by the lengths of the line segments of the straight line in figure 52a around the drop-down point at a composition of phi zero and energy f alpha beta, which is referred to as the lever rule, in German Hebelgesetz. By contrast, panel B of figure 52 shows a situation where mixing is more favorable. Here, the curve of the mixed state lays at values lower than the line of the demixed states. That means, if we have a system with an initial composition phi zero in a demixed state corresponding to an average energy of F alpha beta, which practically manifests itself such that the system will be two-phased with an alpha phase in which our component of interest has a volume fraction phi alpha and a beta phase wherein which our component of interest has a volume fraction phi beta corresponding to free energies F alpha and F beta. And that on average corresponds to an average energy of F alpha beta and an average volume fraction of our component of interest in the system of phi zero. This energy can be spontaneously lowered by mixing and thereby downfall to the curved line at a free energy of F mix. To mathematically distinguish the one from the other scenario, a suitable means is the curvature of the curved Flory-Huggins graph. If this graph has a concave curvature, like it's shown in panel A of figure 52, we have the situation that demixing is more favorable. Whereas by contrast, if the curve has a convex curvature, as it's shown in panel B of figure 52, we have the situation that mixing is favorable. The curvature, in turn, is given to us by the second derivative of a function. So this means if the second derivative of delta f mix as a function of concentration is smaller than zero, this denotes to us a concave curvature and therefore demixing to be favorable, as it's shown in panel A. Whereas by contrast, if the second derivative of delta f mix as a function of phi is larger than zero, this denotes to us a convex curvature, implying that mixing is more favorable. Let's consider some boundary case or extreme quotation marks examples to clarify this principle to us. Our first boundary case example is an ideal mixture. We know from our last lesson unit that in such an ideal mixture, there is no energetic or enthalpic contribution to Gibbs mixing free energy. Delta H mix, or respectively delta U mix, are zero. Only the temperature-dependent entropic contribution remains. This means that the second derivative of delta f mix as a function of phi then turns into minus t times the second derivative of delta s mix as a function of phi, as denoted in equation 4.23. Calculating this from the Flory-Huggins formula 4.22, wherein which we leave out the third summand in the parentheses term by setting chi equal to zero, which is the case in an ideal mixture, we obtain the right-hand side of equation 4.23, that for any value of the variable phi will always be positive. So this corresponds to the scenario where the second derivative of delta f mix as a function of concentration is larger than zero, denoting to us a convex curvature, as it's shown in panel B of figure 52, which is the scenario in which mixing is favorable. This is in line with our intuition, according to which we know already that an ideal mixture will always mix, because here energetic effects are ineffective, only entropy is making a contribution, and entropy is always in favor of mixing, irrespective of the system's composition. The other boundary case example is the opposite. Here, we ignore the entropy term and only look at the energetic contributions. The second derivative of delta f mix as a function of phi is then given according to equation 4.24, into which we can again plug in the Flory-Huggins equation 4.22 and now only regard its lastmost summand because we ignore the entropic part. This gives us a very simple second derivative, which is simply minus 2 times chi times kBT. Here we can distinguish between two scenarios. One scenario is when chi is smaller than zero, when chi is negative. Then we plug in something negative for chi in that equation, and together with the overall minus sign in front of the right side of the equation, this gives us something positive on the right side. This will then correspond to the scenario where the second derivative of delta f mix, as a function of phi, is positive, which denotes to us a convex curvature, as it's shown in panel B of figure 52. And in that scenario, mixing is favorable. That makes perfect sense, because we've just learned in our last lesson unit that a negative value for chi is a rare special case scenario where mixing is indeed energetically favorable. Because the energy balance in the definition equation for the Flory-Huggins chi parameter is then such that the energy gain upon mixing is of greater extent than the energy loss. The establishment of new AB contacts is more favorable than the energy loss that comes along with the breakage of a former AA and a former BB contact in the phase-separated states. By contrast, if we consider the more common situation of chi being positive, chi being larger than zero, the right-hand side of equation 4.24 will be negative, because there is an overall negative sign on it. Then we have the scenario that the second derivative of the mixing free energy as a function of phi is negative, smaller than zero. This denotes to us a concave curvature, as it's shown in panel A of figure 52, indicating a state where mixing is disfavored. Again, this makes perfect sense to us, because as we have just learned in our last lesson unit, that indeed a positive chi is the regular case in which energy is not favorable on mixing, and it depends on entropy to drive a mixing process, which, as we have also learned in our last lesson unit, is more or less easily achievable in the case of a classical low molar mass system, whereas it is hard to achieve in a polymer solution and practically impossible to achieve in a polymer blend. Okay, these two boundary scenarios have clarified to us that this concept of the curvature, as expressed by the second derivative of delta f mixed, the Flory-Huggins equation, as a function of phi, is indeed reliable. In these boundary examples, we have always ignored the one or the other contribution, the energetic or the entropic one. In an actual mixture, however, of course, both are operative. Energetic and entropic contributions will be in the play. So in this case, we must differentiate the full Flory-Huggins equation 4.22 to obtain equation 4.25. With this interplay of both energetic and entropic contributions, curves in a phi-dependent free energy diagram typically look as it's illustrated in figure 53. The curves shown in this figure are for an example of an asymmetric mixture, meaning one where the degree of polymerization of species A and B are a mismatch, which could be a polymer solution, where NA, the degree of polymerization of component A, is large, whereas NB, the degree of polymerization of component B, is small, or precisely 1, denoting to us the elementary lattice side size, which coincides with the segmental size and the solvent molecule size. Due to that asymmetric composition of the system, also the curves in figure 53 are asymmetric. Here we see three curves sketched at three different temperatures: high temperature, medium temperature, and low temperature. The curve at the high temperature is the lowest most one of the three. This curve is convex all over because the entropy term dominates and creates a pronounced global minimum. As a result, at that condition, mixing is favored at all compositions. When we go to lower temperatures, however, the energetic term, which itself commonly disfavors mixing, creates an intermediate miscibility gap in which the curve is locally concave. Here in that region, the system can decrease its free energy by phase separation down to a value represented by the lowest possible straight line that we can construct to the curved curve. Which line does this have to be? This has to be the common tangent that touches the curve in two points close to the two minima, such that its slope coincides with the slope of the curve in the touching points. Where does this criterion come from? It comes from the fact that in those points, we have coexistence of the two states, and a thermodynamic requirement for coexistence is equality of the chemical potentials. And chemical potentials are in fact nothing else than a system's composition-dependent free energy, something like F differentiated for phi, and that very derivative must coincide at the coexistence points of the states, which is where their lines in the diagram touch. With that construction, we can delimit a region of compositions in the middle range, precisely between the two touching point compositions phi prime and phi double prime in figure 53, wherein which our Flory-Huggins function has concave curvature and a straight line lays below the curve. Here, demixing is more favorable, and the system will phase separate at those compositions. By contrast, in the rim regions, at volume fractions smaller than phi prime, respectively larger than phi double prime, the curvature of the Flory-Huggins function is convex, and here a potential straight line that we could construct in those regions would lay above the curved line, corresponding to a scenario as it's plotted in figure 52b. At those compositions, therefore, mixing is favorable. When looking even more thoroughly, we can actually delimit a further subregime by making us clear the following circumstance. The common tangent constructed in figure 53 delimits the stable rim phi regions from the unstable mid phi region. A so to speak bad concave curvature, however, is actually present not in between phi prime and phi double prime, but in between an even more innermost section, namely the section between the inflection points of the curve. So with that, we have to actually delimit three regions. In the outmost rim phi region, as we have already said, the curve has the good convex curvature, so to speak, and here we have stable mixtures. In the innermost phi regime, by contrast, in the region between the inflection points, the curve definitely has the bad, so to speak, concave curvature, and here we have non-miscibility. In the regions between these two extremes, on the one hand side, the curvature is still convex, meaning good for mixing, but on the other hand, nevertheless, the curve lays above the common tangent line, denoting mixing to be unfavorable. This, therefore, is a metastable domain. The regions of stability, instability, and metastability are therefore dependent on the specific free energy curve at hand. This curve, in turn, also varies as a function of temperature, such that, for example, for the case at hand here, further drop of temperature will increase the demissibility region and decrease the rim miscibility regions. We can therefore create a further plot wherein which we denote at what compositions the minima and the inflection points of the free energy curves lay, because those delimit to us the stable rim regions, the instable innermost region, and the metastable region in between them. If we do this as a function of temperature, we are already getting close to our goal of a phase diagram. In a first step, we do so not yet for temperature, but for another parameter that captures the interactions in the system, which is the chi parameter. This is shown to you in figure 54 of our script. Here we see two plots. The upper plot in panel A is again a representation of the free energy as a function of the system's composition. Here this is now shown for a symmetric case, wherein which the degrees of polymerization of species A and B are the same, meaning we either regard a classical regular mixture of two low molar mass components, or we look at a polymer blend with same degrees of polymerization of the two polymers that are blended. The curve that we see is recorded at one specific interaction parameter, chi1, between our two components of interest at that set of experimental variables that are present here in this experimental situation. Again, the curve has two distinct minima, denoting to us the stable rim phi regions. Also again, the curve has two inflection points, denoting to us the definitely instable mid phi region. And the regions in between these characteristic points, the regions between the minima and the inflection points, denotes the metastable regime, where on the one hand side, the curvature is still okay for mixing, but on the other hand side, the straight line that we could construct such that it connects the two minima already lies below the curve. When we project down these characteristic points into panel B, and we do so for a whole set of free energy curves in panel A, each recorded at a different chi parameter, we obtain a plot of chi as a function of phi, denoting to us where the minima on the free energy curve lay, or denoting to us where the inflection points on the free energy curve lay. The first is plotted in blue color in figure 54b, the second is plotted in green color and in dashed denotation in figure 54b. We can see that at very low values of the chi parameter, there is no data set, meaning there we always have a single phase, irrespective of the system's composition. Here, at low chi values, the two components are miscible at any volume ratio. This makes sense to us, because we know already from our last lesson unit that a small chi corresponds to just little energetic disfavorability of mixing, such that the favorable entropy can prevail. By contrast, at larger and larger chi, the more and more dominant disfavorable energetic contribution will create a larger and larger unstable mid-phi regime. There is one characteristic chi at which demixing can first occur, and this is denoted as chi C in figure 54b, the critical chi. In this point, the blue and the green line fall together, which means in the original curve, the minima and the inflection points fall together. Whereas from that point on, at larger chi, both minima and inflection points become identifiable and then spread further and further apart on the phi axis as chi increases, as seen by the widening blue and dashed green line in panel B of figure 54. In the following, we will refer to the blue and the green line in that figure as the binodal and the spinodal line. The binodal separates the stable rim phi regions from the non-stable middle domain, and the spinodal line separates the definitely unstable innermost phi region from the metastable medium phi regions. The point where the two curves fall together is named the critical point, where the system has the critical chi parameter chi c at the critical composition phi c. Footnote, you know something similar already from your elementary physical chemistry 1 education, where you also came across a critical point. That was the one in the van der Waals diagram, where the characteristic van der Waals loops in PV isotherms first occur, and then become pronounced and visible at further decreasing temperature. This is the point where liquefaction of the gas can first occur. In our context here now, this is the point where demixing of the polymer and the solvent can first occur. This demixing happens by two different mechanisms in the regions delimited by the spinodal and the binodal line. In the innermost region between the inflection points, any pre-existing mixture is so unstable that even the smallest fluctuations cause spontaneous phase separation according to a process named spinodal decomposition. Whereas in the regions between the inflection points and the common tangent touching points, the mixture is metastable and therewith robust against small fluctuations. Phase separation, therefore, requires larger fluctuations and then occurs according to a mechanism named nucleation and growth. In the very end of this lesson unit, we will consider these two mechanisms again in a little more detail. Okay, we are almost at our goal already. What we have so far is a representation of a chi versus phi diagram, which we have derived out of a free energy versus phi diagram. In this diagram, we already see regions of miscibility, definite immiscibility, and metastability that we have just discussed a minute ago. So far, we have only qualitatively discussed where the separating binodal and spinodal lines come from. Let's substantiate this a little more and look upon a mathematical derivation of equations for those. Before then, in a final step, we will further translate this representation from a chi versus phi into a t versus phi plot, which combines the two actually relevant and practical variables to characterize the system, temperature and the component's composition in the system. The equation triple 4.26 lists a toolkit that we need for the further mathematical treatment. Equation 4.26a again repeats to us the Flory-Huggins curve, and equations 4.26b and 4.26c represent its first and second derivative, which we both will need because they will have something to do with the minima and the inflection points in the curve, which, as we have just seen, are characteristic points that themselves translate into the binodal and the spinodal lines. For simplicity, we stay in our picture and consider a symmetric mixture, meaning a mixture where the degrees of polymerization NA and NB are the same. This will simplify our further mathematical treatment in two respects. First, we don't need to write NA and NB, but just can write a common N in the equations. And second, this will create us a diagram as it's plotted in figure 45A, where the common tangent is touching the minima of the free energy curves, and not regions close to the minima, but not exactly in the minima, as it was the case in figure 53. This will a lot facilitate the further mathematical treatment, as the minima of the curve are easily calculated. They just follow from the first derivative, which we now consider at the two touching points, phi prime and phi double prime, as it's written in equation 4.27, in which we force the first derivative to be zero at these two composition points. Simple rearrangement of that derivative for the parameter chi gives us the binodal curve, chi as a function of phi, as denoted in equation 4.28. A plot of this line gives us the blue curve in figure 45b. We can furthermore apply a criterion to get the inflection points, which is setting the second derivative zero, as it's done in equation 4.29. Rearranging this for chi gives us the spinodal curve, as denoted in equation 4.30. This is the green dashed line in figure 54b. In the following, we're further interested in the critical point with the coordinates phi critical, chi critical. This is the lowermost point of both the binodal and the spinodal line where they coincide. To get it, we have to calculate the minimum of either of these lines. Let's do so for the spinodal curve, as it's done in equation 4.31a. We take the spinodal line of equation 4.30, differentiate that by phi, and then set this derivative zero. At this point, we can actually even regeneralize our consideration and reintroduce a distinction between degrees of polymerization A and B, which a minute ago we have said that they should be the same. Here, by a little mathematical trick, which is not quite precise but helpful, we can actually regeneralize this consideration to also allow the same formalism to hold for the general case of also non-symmetric blends. When looking onto equation 4.31a, we see that we have two denominators in the parentheses term, one with phi square and one with 1 minus phi square. The phi, as we have said in the beginning of this whole derivation, corresponds to our former phi a, whereas the one minus phi corresponds to our former phi b. So in equation 4.31a, we can actually replace phi square by phi a square and 1 minus phi square by phi b square. And then the n's that are connected to those can only be an a and an b, which transitions the equation in the form s given in number 431b. Solving this for phi gives us the critical composition, as denoted in equation 4.32. This is the composition at which demixing first occurs if chi gets too unfavorable. If we now for a moment again consider the special case of a symmetric blend, for example, a regular mixture, we have NA and NB being the same, for example, both being 1, and then the critical composition is 1 half, it's 0.5. And this is exactly what is shown in figure 45b. At a composition of phi being 1 half, an unstable domain can first occur if chi gets more unfavorable, meaning larger, than chi critical. We can now get the value for this chi critical also by plugging in the critical composition into the spinodal equation 4.30, yielding us equation 4.33. Let us examine this equation in some detail by considering again the three cases of a regular solution, a polymer solution, and a polymer blend. In the case of a regular small molecule solution, we have NA and NB being 1. None of the species is polymerized. When we plug this in into equation 4.33, we obtain a critical chi parameter of 1 half times 1 over 1, which is 1, plus again 1 over 1, which is again 1, so together this is 2 square. So the parenthesis is 2 square, which is 4, and this is multiplied with the 1 half in front of the parenthesis, which in the end gives 2. The critical chi for a regular solution is 2, meaning any two component systems that exhibit a chi larger than 2 will demix if the system's composition is around the critical, whereby it can be further and further away from the critical composition, and demixing will still be observed if the actual chi of that set of substances is more and more greater than the critical chi of 2. If we consider a polymer solution, we have a degree of polymerization of component A very large. This is our polymer. Only component B is not polymerized and exhibits NB being 1. So this means here in the parentheses term, we have 1 over square root of NA, whereby NA shall be large. So this is largely 0, this first summand. And the second summand is 1 over the square root of 1, which is 1. And then we take this 1 to the square, which still gives 1. Together with a prefactor of 1 half, this gives us a critical chi of 1 half. Meaning, in polymer solutions, the critical chi is at a value of 1 half. Everything with an actual chi smaller than the critical one of 1 half will mix, whereas everything with an actual chi larger than the critical one of 1 half will demix if the composition is around the critical one, whereby again it can be further and further deviate from the critical composition and still demix if the actual chi is more and more greater than the critical chi of 1 half. The critical one, 1 half, therefore denotes the state where miscibility transitions into immiscibility. This is the theta state. So that means if we have a system with chi being 1 half, then this is a theta system. Little remark at this point, we've already mentioned with some words at some point close to the end of our last lesson unit that chi itself is a function of system's parameters, including the molar mass or degree of polymerization. This means that if we have a system that is miscible, meaning displaying a chi smaller than the critical one, and then gradually make the solvent quality worse, turning it into a non-solvent. At first, the long-chain fractions will exceed the critical chi and precipitate, whereas the short-chain fractions will still remain dissolved. Their chi is not yet larger than the critical one. This actually allows us to fractionate a polydispersed sample by a technique named precipitation fractionation. We bring a polymer solution of a polydispersed polymer sample to the verge of the theta state, and then make the solvent quality even worse, which we typically either do by changing temperature or by dropwise adding of a bad solvent. Thereby, we will precipitate the polymer, but not all at once, but such that the long chain fractions precipitate first, whereas the short chain fractions precipitate later. And if we do this process stepwise, we can sequentially isolate fractions of increasing molar mass and thereby fractionate our formerly broadly distributed polydispersed sample into a series of more narrowly distributed samples, which we then can analyze and thereby, for example, analytically determine the molar mass distribution, or preparatively creating subfractions that are then further used in experiments where narrow dispersity of the molar mass is needed. The third scenario that we want to consider here is the case of a polymer blend. In this case, both Na and Nb are larger than 1, and if we plug this into equation 4.33, we see that the critical chi is then almost 0. This denotes to us again that mixing of polymers of kind A and B is hardly possible at all, because it only works if the actual chi of the system at hand is lower than the critical one. And when the critical one is already close to 0, this means the actual one must be even closer to 0, or ideally at the other side of 0, meaning at the negative side, which, as we have seen in our last lesson unit, is hardly possible. Not even polystyrene and deuterated polystyrene may fulfill this criterion. Yet again, this shows to us that combining the favorable properties of polymer A and B in one composite system is hardly possible by mixing the polymers on a chain macromolecular level. But what we have to do instead is to either do just nanoscopic or microscopic mixing by grinding down the two polymer samples to micro or nanoparticulate grains and then mix those, or even more elegantly, to do the mixing already along the chain, which is doable by copolymerization of the monomers of type A and B in one unique copolymeric species. Okay, we're almost at our goal. We now have a quantitative understanding of the phase diagram plot shown in figure 45, which shows to us a plot of the thermodynamic parameter chi as a function of phi. An even more practical plot would be one that doesn't feature chi on one axis, but a more practically daily use variable, which is T, temperature. We can easily create such a plot from the chi of phi representation in figure 45b, by making use of the temperature dependence of the chi parameter that we know from our last lesson unit, where it was expressed to us in equation 4.14a. In this equation, chi was conceived as a sum of two increments, chi h and chi s, an enthalpic and an entropic increment. This is written to you again in a handwritten form in the top notation of figure 55. Here we can delimit two scenarios that we have discussed already briefly in our last lesson unit. If the chi h increment is larger than 0, then the overall chi parameter decreases as temperature raises, because the overall chi is composed of a chi s and something that we add upon. And if this something that we add upon is positive, we make the total chi larger, which is generally bad for mixing, because as we have just seen, chi must be smaller than a certain critical one for mixing to occur. Here, however, increase of temperature will attenuate the summand and therefore make the entire chi smaller with increasing temperature, as it's plotted on the left-hand side representation underneath the equation on the top of figure 55. What results from this is a so-called upper critical solution temperature, in short UCST, a system that shows miscibility at high temperatures, whereas it shows immiscibility at low temperatures. This is shown to you in the lowermost representation on the left-hand side in figure 55, which now shows our desired plot of T versus phi with binodal and spinodal lines again. We here actually see two data sets, one represented by blue color and another one represented by green color, that denote different molar masses. The blue one, the upper one, is for high molar mass. The green, the low one, is for low molar masses. Yet again, we see here that if we first have a single phase system, which we have at high temperature, and then drop the temperature, we first pass the UCST point of the high molar mass system and not yet pass the UCST point of the low molar mass system. That means we first precipitate only the long or heavy chains, but not yet the short or light chains, which again gives us a means at hand to fractionate, to separate a polydispersed sample into multiple narrowly dispersed ones. The opposite case is given in a scenario where the chi h increment is negative, smaller than zero, as denoted to us on the right-hand side of figure 55. Here, the overall chi parameter gets larger with increasing temperature, because in the overall chi, we have the chi s increment, and then we subtract something from this if the chi h comes along with a negative sign, which is generally good for mixing because it makes the overall chi smaller. And we know that chi must be small, smaller than a critical one, for mixing to be realized. And this is favorably granted here by a negative chi h increment. However, increase of temperature will attenuate this favorable contribution and therefore make miscibility harder at higher temperature, which results in a lower critical solution temperature, in short, LCST. In our last lesson unit, we already have got to know typical examples for polymer systems that exhibit this kind of temperature sensitivity miscibility, which are predominantly polymers that undergo hydrogen bonding interactions with water as the surrounding medium, which, as we have also seen in our last lesson unit, results in values of the LCST, which are very often close to human body temperature. As in our body, the same operative ensemble is used by nature. The combination of hydrogen bonding interactions to create reversibly bound functional entities and a temperature of body temperature to allow these entities to be assembled and disassembled in a reversible dynamic fashion on demand. Again, on the right-hand side of figure 55, we see two datasets for a high and a low molar mass sample. And again, we see that if we start at the point where miscibility is granted, which here corresponds to low temperatures, and then make the solvent quality worse, which we here do by increasing temperature, we first pass the LCST point of the blue dataset, which corresponds to the high molar mass fractions in the sample, which then will precipitate. Whereas we pass the LCST point of the green dataset, which corresponds to the low molar mass chains in the sample, not yet at this point, but later at even higher temperatures. This again allows us to separate a formerly polydispersed, broadly distributed sample into multiple narrowly dispersed fractions. The UCST and LCST type phase diagrams showed us in figure 55 appear to us as some sort of boundary cases, the one encountered for the one kind of species, the other encountered for the other kind of species, which is practically indeed the case. Fundamentally, however, we actually very often have both behaviors in the same system. A system can both display an LCST and a UCST. The reason why we often only see the one or the other is because usually one of these two characteristic points lays at ranges of temperature that are practically inaccessible. For example, in the sense that we have a UCST at hand that lays below the freezing point of our fluid medium, such that we only observe the LCST of that system. Or vice versa, that we have an LCST that lays beyond the boiling point of our solvent, such that we practically see only the UCST of the sample. Theoretically, however, both is always present, and depending on where they lay mutually to each other, we can have different types of complex shapes of phase diagrams, as illustrated to us in figure 56, in which panel A shows us a situation where we have both an LCST and a UCST, and a mid-region of miscibility on the t-axis, whereas panel B shows the inverse, a system with a closed miscibility gap, and panel C is a variant of panel A, where the two branches of the curves interpenetrate and thereby create an hourglass shape of a phase diagram. The conceptual explanation for this can all be traced back to a common explanation for case A that is visualized to us in panel D of figure 56. Here we see the chi parameter as a function of temperature, and we see that there is actually two contributions that we must consider. The first one is a common Flory-Huggins-related UCST-type course of a temperature-dependent chi, that's represented by the blue curve. And on top of that comes a green contribution, which has to do with the following effect. Upon increase of temperature, we have volume expansion of both components in our system. Usually, the thermal expansion coefficients of component A and B are not the same, meaning they expand differently as temperature increases, which then will make it harder and harder to place them onto the same lattice, so to speak, if we argument in terms of the Flory-Huggins lattice picture. So we must apply a lattice distortion to still be able to fit both the solvent and the polymer on that thermally expand with different extents upon increase of temperature. This creates an entropy penalty that manifests itself like an LCST curve that is also present there. Both effects are present, both are overlaid, and so the resulting curve is one that passes the critical point of chi being 0.5 twice at an upper critical and a lower critical solution temperature. There is one last point that I'd like to make here. We came across it already briefly throughout our discussion, which is the mechanism of phase separation. There is two mechanisms of how phase separation can occur: spinodal decomposition and nucleation and growth. Spinodal decomposition occurs in the unstable innermost phi regime of the phase diagram. Here, a mixed state would be so unstable that any short random concentration fluctuation self-amplifies and eventually leads to macroscopic phase separation. The fundamental physics behind this is that material transport, diffusion, always occurs along a gradient of the chemical potential in the system. Commonly, this coincides with a concentration gradient. As commonly, chemical potential is given as mu is mu zero times RT ln phi. This is the reason why when we have a concentration gradient, this coincides with a chemical potential gradient that flattens and eventually fades away by diffusion. We refer to this as downhill diffusion. In the unstable domain of a phase diagram, however, we have a concave curvature of the composition-dependent free energy diagram, meaning the second derivative of Gibbs free energy with phi is smaller than zero, which we can also express as the first derivative of mu with phi is smaller than zero. Still, diffusion occurs along the chemical potential gradient, which now, however, is against the concentration gradient. We refer to this as uphill diffusion. This means matter spontaneously migrates such that the concentration gradient worsifies, in a sense that the two components A and B dehomogenize, demix, but start to form locally concentrated spots, and that concentration gradient self-amplifies in the further course. First, this phenomenon occurs on intermediate length scales that form as a compromise between the two tendencies that, on the one hand, it's not so favorable if the matter has to diffuse over large distances, and on the other hand, it's also not so favorable if the matter only diffuses over small distances, because that creates many nanoscopic domains of component A and B, and therefore also a lot of interface between these domains, which is thermodynamically disfavorable in view of interfacial energy. The compromise between those is to form a certain domain size that best serves both these requirements that covers intermediate length scales, which is indeed observable by small angle scattering techniques, most predominantly small angle neutron scattering. During later stages of the process, the length scale then diverges and the phase separation then becomes actually macroscopically visible, first by means of optical microscopy and then just by means of an optical magnifying glass. The other mechanism is nucleation and growth. This is what occurs in the metastable regime between the inflection points and the minima of the composition-dependent free energy diagram, where in which the system on the one hand still comes along with the favorable convex curvature, but on the other hand is already in a domain where the straight line of the common tangent is energetically lower, that means more favorable, than the curved curve. Here in this domain, the system can still tolerate small concentration fluctuations. That means spinodal decomposition does not happen here, such that initially the formation of small local clusters of phase-separated domains do not yet make it to macroscopic phase separation, but break apart again. Which is because initially the rays of the interfacial energy that comes along when a cluster of a phase-separated local domain forms is not yet outweighed by the favorable gain of energy that comes along due to phase separation in that metastable domain. Only if a certain critical minimal cluster size, R star, is surpassed, the gain of the bulk energy of the then phase-separated domains outweighs the unfavorable creation of interfacial energy. This is shown to you in figure 57 of our script. And figure 58 of the script again summarizes what kind of phase separation occurs in what kind of domain in the composition-dependent free energy diagram. With this, we're at the end of this lesson unit. We have now completed the picture that we have began to develop in our last, the seventh lesson unit, by making us clear at what conditions exactly, meaning at what set of state variables, which are most practically composition and temperature, a system of two components A and B, whereby one or even two can be polymers, is in miscible or immiscible states. We have actually seen that we have to widen our scope even more and not only distinguish between this duality of miscibility versus immiscibility, but in fact have to consider three domains, a stable one, an instable one, and a metastable one. We have seen that, in addition to the system's composition, a decisive parameter of influence is the Flory-Huggins interaction parameter that delimits these three regions in a phase diagram. We can further translate this into a representation of a more practically relevant variable, which is temperature, by making use of the temperature dependence of the Flory-Huggins chi parameter. This has actually shown to us two elementary boundary cases of temperature-dependent miscibility versus immiscibility, which is lower critical solution temperature, LCST, and upper critical solution temperature, UCST kind of systems. Here at this point, we encounter a striking uniqueness or delimitation of polymer systems from classical low molar mass chemistry systems. In those systems, a phenomenon of an LCST kind of phase separation is rare, because in those systems, the main driving force for mixing is entropy, which therefore leads to a situation that actually many systems are miscible at practically all compositions of the system. Because the entropy is so strong in those systems, that mixing is in the end always favored. This is different in polymer systems. Here we have seen already in our last lesson unit that entropy has a lot less power due to the strong degree of pre-ordering of the molecules in the system due to their connectivity to chains. This, based upon what we have learned in the following course, can then actually create the so far to us unknown scenario of a lower critical solution temperature, a system that is miscible at low temperatures and demixes at high temperatures. We have seen already that these kinds of systems are actually very relevant and promising in the field of polymer science, as they are the systems that most closely match the situation and the state of variables encountered in living body environments, rendering them promising for potential biomedical applications. So with that, we should forget our so far practical chemistry rule of thumb that was like, if it doesn't dissolve, then heat up. In classical low molecular weight chemistry, indeed this rule of thumb holds. What we actually do when doing so is we empower the entropy term in the Gibbs free energy and therefore make mixing more favorable by heating up. In polymer systems, we have seen that this rule can in fact not only not help, but by contrast make the situation worse, as we may have a system with an LCST type miscibility at hand, and there increasing temperature does indeed not help mixing, but instead decreasing of temperature would help mixing. From now on and forever, do no longer forget this when conducting practical polymer science. To mix things, it's good to try heating, but it's also good to try cooling. We have seen at diverse points of our thermodynamic discussion so far that a central quantity is the Flory-Huggins parameter. Today we have seen where its critical values lie, and that is of elementary relevance to appraise the state of solubility and solvent quality of a given polymer solvent system at hand. What we do not yet have, however, is an experimental means to determine the Flory-Huggins parameter. This will be on the agenda of our next lesson unit.